This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, the Wisconsin Film Festival recently aired a restored version of the 1946 movie The Best Years of Our Lives, which earned famous UW-Madison graduate Frederick March an Oscar. We'll talk about March's life and the controversy over the removal of his name from two UW campus buildings. Now, a new documentary explores great religious architecture in the United States. The Washington National Cathedral in D.C., the Air Force Academy Chapel in Colorado, the Mormon Tabernacle in Salt Lake City, and religious buildings in Wisconsin, like the Annunciation Greek Orthodox Church in Milwaukee, designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. The filmmakers say that religious architecture is trying above all to tell a story. Mike Trinkline is a co-founder of the film production company Betcher and Trinkline, Inc. His latest film is the documentary Secrets of Sacred Architecture, which airs on several Wisconsin channels starting today. Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
What led you on this tour and then sharing it with us of religious buildings around the United States?
Oh, I think my co-producer, Steve Betcher, and I have been going to church our whole lives. And, you know, when you're a little kid and you get a little bored in church, you look around and wonder, what's all this stained glass doing here? Why is it designed this way? And as you move from church to church and they're so different, you try to understand what it's all about. And I think that kind of led us to want to make this film.
What kind of places did you find close to home here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I mean, Wisconsin, the nice thing about Wisconsin is that, like pretty much every part of the country, there's an example of every really kind of church architecture right within any given city. And so there's all the various samples. There's great Gothic churches. There's great Romanesque churches. There's all kinds of beautiful styles and more modern styles as well. But I think the one that was really interesting to me locally was Annunciation, this church in Milwaukee built by Frank Lloyd Wright. And it's like this bowl, and then on top of the bowl is another bowl that's upside down. And it's so Frank Lloyd Wright. I mean, he was very much into sort of egalitarianism. And so everybody in that church is close to the altar. No one's more than 60 feet away. Of course, the downside, like every Frank Lloyd Wright church, it leaks. That's always the problem with his work.
That's part of the story you're trying to tell in the documentary, I think, is how these churches and their architecture tells a story. How did you unlock that? How did you help interpret what the visual that I might see and say, oh, yeah, it looks cool, what story it's telling?
Yeah, even if you're driving by at 50 miles an hour, churches are trying to talk to you. And just to sort of understand that language can just make things that much more fulfilling. I mean, here's an example. Steeples. Why do churches have steeples? Well, some people might say, when I was in, you know, kindergarten, they would say, oh, they're pointing up to God. And they do. That's part of it. But the other part of it is they're really serving the same function as, say, the McDonald's arches. They're saying, hey, we're here. Check us out. We've got a story to tell. That's a good story. You want to be a part of us. And we've got the tallest steeple in town. And we're here. And it's sort of a marker of a particular church community.
Those are the big things you might see from the outside. Did you find some cool little nuances that you might have even walked by if you're visiting and not making a documentary?
Yeah, here's my favorite one. So a typical church in Wisconsin has stained glass windows, and in those windows are depicted various Bible scenes. Well, it costs a lot of money. Tiffany made a lot of those windows. They're very expensive. So a church would find a well-off donor who would pay for the window. What Tiffany would do, and all the stained glass companies, is they would say, huh, why don't we take the face of the donor and make him, in the church window, say the Apostle Paul or Peter? And so a lot of these church windows actually have real people from the congregation depicted. Now, that was 100 years ago. It's been forgotten. No one remembers that when you walk into the church, that guy up there is actually a guy who used to be a member of the church. So it's just kind of funny how there are people kind of finding these things out, rediscovering that little tidbit of history from days gone by.
Now, to narrate this story, you reached out to someone very familiar to public television audiences and to Star Trek fans, LeVar Burton. And it turned out he was really on the same page as you guys. What did he say when you asked him to do this?
Yeah, he was happy to do it and ecstatic about doing it. He did study for the ministry at one point in his life. And, you know, he's a favorite for PBS audiences and just a guy who's really great to work with and really sort of took on the task of really making this shine. And I think he was a great choice.
As we wrap up, Mike, could you talk about what you're hoping people come away with after they watch the documentary and how they look at maybe their own congregation's building or others in their community?
Oh, yeah. I mean, churches were built to tell a story, and a lot of times the story is sort of a mystery to the people who walk in the church. They've sort of always done it and haven't really looked critically. So once you watch the film, you'll walk into your own church and go, oh, that's why that is, or that's tying to something 1,000 years ago, or that's tying to something 2,000 years ago. There's all these little subtle cues in every church that are connecting to something larger, and that's really what the film is hoping to unlock for people. There's a bigger picture here, and you can really get a more fulfilling experience if you know what all those little details tie back to.
Mike, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Mike Trinkline is a co-founder of the film production company Betcher & Trinkline, Inc. He talked to us about their latest film, the documentary called Secrets of Sacred Architecture. That airs on Channel 36 WMTV today. You can watch it on Wisconsin Public Television on April 18th. Look online for your local public TV station to find out when, where, and how. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about a one-hit wonder from Stoughton.
So what are some of your early memories of rock and roll? For Stoughton's Bill Amundson, there's one that happened really close to home, like right down the street.
It was a normal Saturday spring morning at the Amundson household on Norris Street in Stoughton, Wisconsin.
This is Detective Huckleberry Hound.
The year was 1960, and I was a seven-year-old boy watching Huckleberry Hound when my dad burst into the room. He said, "The band that's on the radio, they're practicing in the garage right down the street." He then proceeded to hustle my brother and I down to the old Hanson garage, where we had a front row seat to a rehearsal by Stoughton's very own one-hit wonders, the Fendermen.
Good morning, Captain. Well, good morning to you.
Phil Humphrey was living in Stoughton, working as a truck driver and taking classes at the UW when he met Jim Sundquist of Niagara, Wisconsin. The two quickly bonded over their Fender guitars and the unusual fact that they shared the same birthday, November 26th, 1937. They formed a duo, dubbed themselves the Fendermen, and began playing gigs at small clubs and bars around southern Wisconsin. Their set was mostly country and rockabilly standards, but they couldn't help but notice that folks went wild for their rather unhinged cover of the old Jimmy Rogers song, Blue Yodel No. 8, usually called Mule Skinner Blues. They tried selling the 45 on their own, with little luck, until a lacrosse DJ named Lindy Shannon became obsessed with the song and played it into their local top 10. From there, it was picked up by the Soma label out of Minneapolis, who released it nationally and sent it soaring into the Billboard Hot 100, where it reached number 5 in June of 1960. By the end of the summer, Mule Skinner Blues had sold well over 1 million copies. The song itself was unusual. It featured just the two Fendermen, drenched in echo, no drums or bass, with Humphrey's delirious whooping and yodeling. Highlights included a number of deranged a-yuck, a-yucks, and ha-has, and concluded with the classic cha-cha-cha. As the song took off, the now four-piece band continued to rehearse in that old garage on Main Street in Stoughton, and we kept a lookout for them so we could gather outside at a moment's notice. Mostly, we just stared in reverent jaw-dropping awe, not believing our luck. After all, the Fendermen, although practically teenagers themselves, were the biggest celebrities any of us had ever seen in our short, small-town Stoughton lives. By summer's end, they'd opened for Johnny Cash and Kitty Wells and appeared at the Grand Old Opry. A performance on Dick Clark's American Bandstand would follow, where they shared the bill with teen heartthrob Bobby Darin, who seemed downright subdued by comparison. And then, just like that, it was over. They released a full album called, you guessed it, Mule Skinner Blues, and continued to play as a popular live act. But amidst legal wranglings with their record company and without a follow-up hit, they disbanded in 1961. But Mule Skinner Blues lives on. To date, it has sold over 4.5 million copies worldwide and is a staple on oldies radio stations everywhere. The Fendermen may have provided Stoughton with only a footnote in the history of American music, but they made a lifelong rock and roll fan out of one 7-year-old living just around the corner. on Nora Street.
Bill Amundson is an artist and rock and roll fan from Stoughton, and his essay was originally published in the Stoughton Courier-Hub. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Colbert.
Coming up, we'll find out why the name of actor and famous UW-Madison alum Frederick March was removed from two UW campus buildings and the pushback that decision has gotten in the years since. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. The Wisconsin Film Festival screened a newly restored version of The Best Years of Our Lives last week. The 1946 film earned actor and UW-Madison graduate Frederick March an Oscar for Best Actor. March's history at UW-Madison, though, has been the subject of controversy in the last few years. In 2018, UW-Madison removed his name from a campus building after he was found to have been part of a student honor society with the name Ku Klux Klan. UW-Oshkosh followed suit in 2020. A UW investigation found the group had no known ties to the larger racist Knights of the Ku Klux Klan organization. After the name changes, prominent historians and civil rights advocates have argued removing his name was a mistake. George Gonis is a freelance journalist and public historian who says UW got this decision wrong. George, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Good to be with you.
Before we get to the back and forth over the name removal, can you remind us, for those who didn't follow his career, who Frederick March was?
Frederick March, he's a Racine native. He graduated from the University of Wisconsin-Madison in 1920. He continued to be in touch with the university in big ways his entire life. He is considered one of the great seminal actors of the 20th century. When you talk about the actors of the 20th century, it's usually Spencer Tracy and Frederick March, both Wisconsin products. He's still the only actor in history to win two Oscars and two Tonys for Best Actor. No male actor has done that to date. Of course, you mentioned that he won the Oscar for The Best Years of Our Lives. He's also appeared, and this was no accident, in one socially conscious film after another, because that was his lifetime agenda. So The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit, 7 Days in May, two pro-Jewish anti-Nazi films before the war started, Victory, and So Ends Our Night. One of his last films was Tick, 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 with Jim Brown as an African-American sheriff in a southern small town, and Frederick March being the small town mayor. And he purposely came out of retirement to do that film because the topic was so important to him.
And you write in a piece you wrote about this whole controversy that he was an ally to the civil rights movement off the screen. Can you talk about that as well?
Very much so. In fact, it's a towering resume. He was for more than 50 years, he was one of the more public advocates on behalf of racial justice. He had a 30-year intimate close alliance with the NAACP. He was one of the founders of the Hollywood Anti-Nazi League in 1936 with Dorothy Parker and Oscar Hammerstein, two other racial justice firebrands. In 1939, seminal civil rights event, Marian Anderson, the great opera singer, contralto, African-American woman, is refused. They refused to allow her to perform in Constitution Hall. And so the NAACP starts sending out hundreds of telegrams to try to recruit noteworthy people to come out on Marian Anderson's behalf. The response to these hundreds of telegrams is pretty much, we can't get involved in anything so controversial. There are only four Hollywood and Broadway stars who partake in this after those hundreds of telegrams. Katharine Hepburn, Tallulah Bankhead, and Frederick March and his wife, actress Florence Eldridge. They even left. They were performing. March and his wife were performing in a anti-Nazi play on Broadway, The American Way, a play fighting anti-Semitism, and they made sure that they flew from that performance in New York to D.C. to be at Marian Anderson's concert, and they were actually, you know, they appear as sponsors on that that famous Lincoln Memorial concert that Marian Anderson gave to push back against the Daughters of the American Revolution, keeping her from performing the Constitution Hall. Frederick March was an elemental part of that. In fact, he and his wife and Marian Anderson were friends for the rest of their lives, both involved in civil rights activities and just socializing, having barbecues at each other's home.
Now, the controversy came out about Frederick March's membership in a group, I believe his senior year at UW-Madison, a group that called itself the Ku Klux Klan. What did you find when you looked into that?
Yeah, but part of the problem in this saga all along has been the name, Frederick March's name was stripped both in Madison and at UW-Oshkosh before any actual research was done into the nature of that honor society and the origin of its name, let alone Frederick March's actual 50-year career in civil rights. And so the name has been kind of mischaracterized and misunderstood from the beginning. I think a good way to start out might be thinking about this might be taking a lesson from the San Francisco chapter of the NAACP. A couple of years ago, in fact, this has been in the national news for over the last two or so years, there were WPA murals in a San Francisco high school that a large group of people condemned because they felt those murals celebrated racism, slavery, and genocide. But the San Francisco chapter of the NAACP said, wait a second, we need to do research here. And the NAACP took it upon itself to do that research and discovered that the artist who undertook those murals was in fact a racial justice firebrand himself, and in fact that the murals were a critique of racism, slavery, and genocide in America. And said, absolutely, those murals, and along with one of the alums, the great actor Danny Glover, also agreed with the NAACP, those murals need to be maintained. The lesson here, how it attaches to the Frederick March situation, is the NAACP in San Francisco just came out and said, you know, things aren't always what they first appear to be, which is why you need to do thorough research. And I would guess another comparison might be the swastika shape, which is, of course, since 1930s on, has been about as poisonous a symbol as you can think of. And yet for centuries through today, it's also a benign and ubiquitous symbol used by the Navajo people and many cultures in Africa and Asia. So with those two examples in mind, some of the leading progressive civil rights and Klan historians have weighed in on this, meaning Frederick March is the name origin of this honor society. And so, and this includes people like Ray Arsenault, who's the John Hope Franklin Professor of Southern History at the University of South Florida, Stephen Whitfield of Brandeis, Robert Goldberg at the University of Utah, and maybe most importantly, Lonnie Bunch III, who's the Secretary of the Smithsonian. He's the founding executive director of the John Lewis Berth National Museum of African American History and Culture. And all of these scholars have determined that March's Honor Society only very coincidentally shared a name with the terrorist hate group. That the name of March's Honor Society actually predated any national awareness of the so-called, what historians call the Second Klan, aka the Invisible Empire, the group that terrorized the country later in the 1920s. And in fact, that this Honor Society was exactly what it said it was, an honor society designed to, pretty much asking each fraternity on campus to nominate its outstanding junior year campus achiever. And that's what it was. And if I may.
We just have a couple minutes left, but I want to share a statement from the Wisconsin Union this afternoon. They said March's contributions to the civil rights movement were considered when they decided to remove his name. And I'm going to quote, they say, overwhelmingly, community members and visitors expressed strong objection to naming a student performance space after any individual connected with a group bearing the name of Ku Klux Klan, regardless of the group's functions or actions. They go on, they took into account that it wasn't related to that National Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. So what do you say to their response there? And we just have a minute and a half left or so.
Yeah, I would say, for one thing, that's just not how things unfolded. March's name was removed there are two biographies written about Frederick March, which document his social justice activism. University officials at both universities told me those were never consulted at the time. They also never consulted the Frederick March papers filled with letters from Roy Wilkins, the NAACP executive director, who invited Frederick March to be the keynote speaker at the 10th anniversary celebration of Brown versus Board of Education in 1964. The Frederick March papers, just 30 yards across the street at the revered Wisconsin Historical Society, were never consulted. These dozens upon dozens of civil rights histories by Pulitzer Prize winners were never consulted. Frederick March's name is in the index in all its protagonist glory in all of those. They did not talk to people that I talked to, like Harry Belafonte, Ed Asner, who was living at the time, people who knew Frederick March, who were contemporaries of Frederick March, whose lives overlapped with Frederick March. The decision to remove March was there were only accusations, false accusations, that he was a white supremacist and a Klan member. No one making those accusations, no one responsible for removing his name, searched those books, searched the Frederick March papers, interviewed these Pulitzer Prize winning professors who have studied the Klan, who've studied Frederick March. That never happened. So when the university produces that statement, it's not a true statement. And I guess for me, to close out perhaps, the supreme irony is that Frederick March's 50-plus year civil rights resume monumentally dwarfs that of any of the individuals responsible for both removing his name and keeping it off both theaters on both campuses.
That's George Gonis. Thanks for joining us today with us to talk about the life of actor and UW-Madison graduate Frederick March and why he says the decision to remove March's name from two UW campus buildings was a mistake. You're listening to Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then as family dairy farms continue to decline in numbers around the state, farmers are pushing for a supply management program they're calling the Dairy Revitalization Plan. We'll hear from members of the Farm Bureau and Wisconsin Farmers Union on how that plan could change the 2023 Farm Bill. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the UW system is delaying a free speech survey for students on its campuses. We'll talk to one of the organizers of that survey about what they're trying to measure. First, dairy farmers around the state are coming together to call for changes in milk production regulations in the U.S. Farm Bill. They're calling the proposed legislation the Dairy Revitalization Plan. Members of the Wisconsin Farmers Union and of local Wisconsin Farm Bureau Federation groups are working together through the nonprofit Dairy Together. That group is asking Congress to stabilize dairy prices to help slow the loss of family farms. According to Dairy Together, that would mean elevating milk prices, preventing dairy overproduction, and reducing milk price volatility, among other things. Dairy Together is hoping the legislation will be part of the 2023 Farm Bill. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about your life and your livelihood? Are you a dairy farmer yourself struggling with profitability, or have you gotten out of the dairy business yourself? Whoever you are, wherever you are, do you want to see changes in how milk production is managed in Wisconsin, in the United States? Do you have questions for our guests? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Travis Klinkner is a board member of the Vernon County Farm Bureau and an organic dairy farmer in Wisconsin. Travis, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And Darren Von Ruden is the Wisconsin Farmers Union vice president. He also owns an organic dairy in the state. Darren, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Darren, before we get to these proposed changes, let's talk about the problem we hear again and again over the years, a declines in the number of farms in Wisconsin, dairy farms in Wisconsin and elsewhere. What are some of the biggest challenges you're trying to tackle here?
Well, certainly trying to make sure that there's enough income coming back to the farm to make sure that the generation that's farming it today can be there for tomorrow, and then our grandkids and great-grandkids can also have that opportunity. And really the biggest challenge is that income side of the equation. We've continued to fight with below cost of production pricing for our products for many years now. And looking at the dairy revitalization plan, I think we found a mechanism that can probably help stem that tide.
Travis, can you talk about maybe what you've experienced or other Farm Bureau members you talk to have experienced when it comes to, you know, what happens when the price of milk drops, but your input costs don't? Maybe they even go up.
Frustration. That's probably the number one thing most farmers can relate to. As you know, when this happens, and we all can recognize that there is at times an excess of milk on the market. A lot of our cooperatives have put us on at times different type of quotas to actually limit our productions just because they're having a hard time moving that product. And that's kind of what led us to this dairy revitalization plan of finding a way to nationally manage that so that individual co-ops aren't taking on that burden of having to limit its own producers while others who are shipping to an independent dairy creamery or even other cooperatives who don't have some type of limitation on can just keep adding on more milk, contributing sometimes to an already exacerbated problem.
Darren, I know supply management can be a really controversial issue in dairy. There are concerns, you know, if the federal government is setting these strict caps on things. How are you trying to thread that needle with this plan? How are you looking at supply management?
Well, certainly it's the plan that we're looking at is not going to say you can't produce any milk. We certainly have a history of around a 2% growth in the annual needs within the country. So this program hopefully will accommodate some of those concerns. Also, the language that we're using, that's why we're saying dairy growth management versus supply management, because really what we want to do is grow the industry. We don't want to restrict it to something that wouldn't be palatable for farmers across country. Now, of course, we're certainly going to see those folks that don't want to see any restrictions or controls on them whatsoever. We'll fight the plan tooth and nail. But, you know, looking at the future, you know, it's really good for the country as a whole to make sure that we have a very diverse set of dairy producers. And, you know, the way we're going, there's going to be fewer and fewer of us on a daily basis. And what we really want to see working within the Dairy Together program is trying to make sure that we have more producers instead of fewer producers.
Travis, I wanted to ask about the process for coming up with this plan. This has been, if I'm understanding correctly, years in the making. Can you talk a little bit about the road to coming up with this plan?
Yeah, this has been a long, long road, and I'm actually jumping in the middle of it. There's been work done by the Holstein Association all the way back in 2009. And they actually came close to getting parts of something like this in the Farm Bill back in 2010 and 14, but they failed at the last minute. And so when my cooperative, Westby Creamery, had put us organic producers on a quota, and I came across the Dairy Together meetings where they had Canadian farmers come in and talk, I was interested. I was intrigued because at that time we were being limited by our co-op, and I wanted to see if there was a different way of how we could have handled that as a co-op. And I walked away just awestruck and with 10,000 times more questions. And so I've dug in deep to this, researching different thoughts, different plans, a lot of discussions from people across the nation, from California to Vermont to, you know, Missouri and Kentucky. You know, and there's a common thread that everyone recognizes there's an oversupply of milk, but it's how do we implement something nationally that's palatable to all size of producers, all markets of milk. And like Darren alluded to, we still want the, you know, markets to grow because there is domestic demand growing every year at 2%. But as a industry or dairy farmers, we're actually producing 3 to 3.5% more. So it's 1 and 1.5% excess of milk that we're burdening ourselves with and causing our prices to somewhat suffer because we have to get rid of this product and we're selling it below cost. And that just in turn lowers everything else. So we've come together. We've worked together with a lot of different individuals. You know, myself, a Farm Bureau member, has been working with some farmers union members to strategize, because it needs to be industry wide. You know, it's not just one group that's going to move this. There's got to be a general consensus on this to accomplish that. And so we've been working really hard to put together a plan that allows for growth. It's accommodating to large and small farms. It allows for new and beginning farmers to come in. That's one limitation that we hear a lot of, you know, that, well, how is something that's limiting, you know, the growth of milk and you're suppressing, you know, supply, how is a new guy going to get in? And so we've put measures in to allow for that, you know, and we still rely on exports. You know, that's a big part of, you know, us as dairy producers, we rely on exports. And so we don't want something to hinder that also. So we've worked really hard to come up with a plan that we feel accommodates a lot of those big ticket items.
Now, Darren, people might be listening and thinking, hey, I eat cheese, I drink milk. If we're limiting the increase in production from year to year, do I end up paying much more?
Yeah, so Dr. Stevenson and Dr. Nicholson did do some research into that, too. And they're looking at, you know, if the plan was implemented, let's say 5 years ago, it might have raised the price of a gallon of milk or a pound of cheese anywhere from 10 to 15 cents. But that also means that the farmer was probably going to be getting another $1.20 to $1.40 per hundredweight for the milk that they produce, which in turn would probably have our numbers of dairy farmers in the state right now over the 10,000 farm mark versus the under 7,000 that we're at. So, you know, implementation, yes, it's going to raise that price. But right now we're seeing more than that raise in price because of our fuel prices and the energy costs that are going into moving dairy products around the country. So, you know, looking at it, is it worth it? I think a lot of consumers I talk to anyway, are willing to spend that extra 10 to 15 cents to make sure that there's more dairy farms left out in the countryside.
We're talking about a farmer-proposed dairy revitalization plan and what the future holds for dairy production. Darren Von Ruden is with the Wisconsin Farmers Union. Travis Klinkner, board member of the Vernon County Farm Bureau. They are working in the process of trying to get this dairy revitalization plan into next year's farm bill. You can join in now at 800-642-1234. If you are a dairy farmer yourself or a former dairy farmer, or you live in a community that relies on it, what do you think of the ideas you're hearing from our guests? Are you on board? Do you have questions? Do you have concerns about this? Do you wonder about the impact on smaller scale farms versus larger scale farms? If you are a consumer of dairy products, what are you wondering about now? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with dairy farmers Travis Klinkner and Darren Von Ruden. Travis is with the Vernon County Farm Bureau Board, and Darren is vice president of the Wisconsin Farmers Union. They are talking about a dairy revitalization plan, a plan to manage the supply of dairy, hoping to keep prices sustainable for dairy farmers in Wisconsin and beyond. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences, your thoughts, your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jim is with us in Hollandale. Jim, hi.
Hello. Darren, you know me and I know you. Anyway, the main reason I'm going to continue to lose producers is because the price of milk is controlled by the wrong people. I mean, the federal order system, anyway. Mm-hmm. The federal order system sets it up so that there are four classes of milk. And in this state, 85% of the milk goes into the cheese vat. So the price of a pound of cheese, which when you break it down, it takes 10 pounds of cheese, 10 pounds of milk to make 1 pound of cheese, 100 pounds of milk to make 10 pounds of cheese. the price of cheese is what determines what the milk price is, mostly in the state of Wisconsin's Class 3 milk. But if it gets too high, like it did 2 years ago, when it was $2.80 a pound for cheese, the dairy producers should have gotten about $28 a hundred for their milk. Instead of getting $28 a hundred for their milk, the federal milk marketing order system, that's what I was trying to think of, reblended the price of all the rest of the classes of milk, fluid, yogurt, and powder, all into one price. So it got the price the dairy farmers got down to $18 a hundred.
Jim, thanks for the call. Darren, is the system weighed against farmers on the price per 100 weight there?
Well, it certainly is, and that's, you know, one of the things that we're looking at, you know, is how do we price that product? This plan is trying to bring stability into the program. You know, we can see swings on a yearly basis of anywhere from $7 to $10 a hundred weight, either up or down. Some years we see it go both ways, and so it's really hard for a farmer to budget on what they're going to spend on products that they need, or are they going to look at maybe a small expansion or an investment in something else off the farm. But you know, certainly looking at that swing, it's really hard to do that. And something that we want to see with the revitalization plan is to get some more stability in that pricing. And, to really answer the question that Jim was asking, that's something that is controlled by the USDA through the federal order system. It would take an act of Congress to change that pricing mechanism, which is something else that a lot of dairy farmers are talking about right now.
Jim, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. And both Jim and Darren there, Travis, brought up a really important part of this. It's not just low prices, but volatile prices and how impossible it seems like it would make it to plan for your operation over the next couple of years if you don't know if prices are going to be okay or just bottom out suddenly. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, I agree. That's the one thing that we aim to gain by this plan is the reduction of volatility. And that was the one thing that Mark Stevenson and Chuck Nicholson, through their modeling, were able to show is it took a lot of that volatility out of there. You know, and Jim brings up a great point. You know, there's a lot of things I think that need to be fixed with the whole dairy system. And one of them is pricing. And how that price is discovered, you know, it doesn't seem fair when cheese is $2.80 and we're not getting that. That something probably needs to change there. But like Darren said, that requires an act of Congress. And what we're trying to introduce here is just one of the many steps to, you know, improve the dairy system. And the first is to recognize that there's an oversupply of milk. If we can begin to manage that, we can take out some volatility. If there's interest after that to work on finding new ways to price our milk, you know, and determine that price for a more fair price for the farmer, a more fair price to the consumer, and a more fair price to the processor, I'm definitely open to that also.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Terry now in Milton. Terry, hi.
Hi. Yes. I'm wondering what's happening to the quality of our milk. With whole milk today, it seems that, to me anyways, that there's no body to the milk anymore. There's no milk fats. It's like 2% milk was a few years back. And I understand that because they can get higher prices for the milk fats, they're putting it somewhere else.
Terry, thanks for the call. Not exactly on our pricing topic, Darren, but you want to take a stab at that? Have the standards for what whole milk is and the way we measure that changed at all?
Yes, it has. And that's been part of the dynamics of the nutrition system that we live in, nutrition titles throughout the country. If we actually would have the California milk standards throughout the country, we would be using more of that or keeping more of that milk fats in the whole milks, the 2% milks, even the 0.5% milk. But over the years, the processors have seen that there's profits to be made in taking those milk fats out of the fluid milk and putting it into cheese, yogurts, butters, you know, all the different products. And so that's why we've seen that reduction. Totally agree. I don't think we have the same flavor in 2% milk today that we had 25, 30 years ago.
Terry, thanks for that call. We're talking about the dairy industry calls for change in the next farm bill. Darren Von Ruden is with us from the Wisconsin Farmers Union. Travis Klinkner, board member of the Vernon County Farm Bureau. They are both on board with some changes they see needed. Travis, we hear again and again the number of dairy farms in Wisconsin has gone down. Milk production has gone up. Size an issue, the scale of operations. Is this a plan that helps bigger operations, smaller, medium, more than other sizes?
Yeah, it's a hard to find a program that's probably a one-size-fits-all where everyone's just a winner, winner, chicken dinner. but what we've hoped to have gained here is a plan that allows the opportunity for every size farm to grow, whether you're a 20, 30 cow, 60 cow dairy to 1,000, 10,000 cow dairy. If you decide to grow within your allowable growth, you could be rewarded by receiving some payments back. If you're an individual who's bringing a son or a daughter or a partner on, and you want to grow faster, you're still allowed to do that. You may have to pay what we call a market access fee to do that. But we've tried to make that market access fee not a large hindrance to put somebody out of business. We want everyone to succeed. But, you know, if you're growing faster than what the market's demanding, you're going to have to compensate for that versus the guy who's going to stay within his lane and stay where he's at, you know. And it's been a challenge because the industry isn't growing like it was, you know, 40-some years ago where a guy brought his son on and, you know, they maybe added 5 or 10 cows. That these farms in, you know, these other states like Colorado and Idaho and Michigan and Texas, where they're not just adding 10 to 100 cows, they're adding tens of thousands of cows. And they're the ones that are in some ways creating more of these issues. And so we're trying to put in a plan in place that they can still do that if they want. But those of us that stay within our lanes, we're not going to get hurt as badly by them doing that.
Now, Darren, you're working on a big, complicated thing, dairy regulation, in the midst of one of the biggest, most complicated bills Congress does on a regular basis, the U.S. Farm Bill, with lots of moving parts. How are you hoping to see this, you know, this movement you've gotten from local farmers from different groups and different sizes and things like that? How are you hoping to get that on the political map in next year's Farm Bill negotiations?
Well, it's truly an uphill battle, but everything in this country tends to start at the bottom and work its way up. We've got quite a few years of experience at working this program now under our belt, and we're certainly hoping that it'll catch the attention of our elected officials. But being at the early stages of the Farm Bill is really important. If we came in at the 23rd hour of the 24-hour Farm Bill process, we probably won't get much attention. But being we're in the beginning stages of Farm Bill debate and having this conversation today amongst farm organizations and farmers themselves, certainly should bring the spotlight to the need for some revitalization within the dairy industry.
And Travis, just briefly, if a dairy farmer is listening, wants to learn more about what you're trying to do, how can they check it out?
If they can go to dairymarkets.org, Mark and Chuck Stevenson's website, to the UW system, they have a calculator there, or maybe an easier way to get to it would be to go to the Dairy Together website. And I know they have a link there where you can actually put your own production numbers in as a producer and see how, if this plan would have been implemented back in 2014, you can play around with it and see how it would have affected you. The one thing I would advise producers to do if you're a dairy farmer looking into this is look at it in a different way. You know, we've typically gone, when you see a farm expand, it's an expansion from 60 cows to 300 to 400 cows, you know, overnight. With this type of plan, if you're going to try and, you know, for lack of better words, beat the system, You may want to look at, you know, growing in smaller steps.
And we'll have to leave it there. Thanks to Travis Klinkner with the Vernon County Farm Bureau, Darren Von Ruden with the Wisconsin Farmers Union, looking at a call for new dairy regulations in the U.S. Farm Bill.